The Lifeboat Hour with Michael Rupert, Sundays at 9 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Nightclub at the end of the world. Yeah, this is Michael C. Rupert again. Here we are on August 14th, 2011, at the end of a brutal week and the start of what we hope may not be a brutal week next week. We have an amazing show tonight that I've been looking forward to for a long time. We have two guests, and this is such a big show that we're going to roll without a station break tonight. We want as much time with them as possible. Before we introduce Peter Charles Downey and David Holmgren, let me just run through a couple of updates for you. It was looking up until about a few hours ago that tomorrow could have been the start of as turbulent a week as last week. It looks like for a moment we have a respite, in spite of the fact that the Singapore GDP contracted by 3.6% and Hong Kong something like 1.2%. The numbers, the exact numbers, are on the CollapseNet homepage now. And Japanese GDP is obviously contracting as Japan is being consumed with radioactive food now. There's fresh stories emerging about cesium-tainted fish, and we now know that probably hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people have eaten contaminated material. At any rate, the Nikkei has opened up a little bit, so everybody's kind of breathing a sigh of relief. But let me just say real quickly that we've all heard of the butterfly effect, where, you know, a butterfly flapping its wings somewhere can, well, right now, if a butterfly burped, the whole global economic house of cards would come down. I'm going to look at one short story before we bring Peter and David on. And this is a Reuters story from August 12th. Financial lifeboats starting to get crowded. It's by Agnes Crane, dated August 12th. The author is a Reuters Breaking Views columnist. The opinions expressed are her own. Quote, the financial lifeboats are starting to get crowded. Investors in droves have sought safety in Uncle Sam's debt and even bonds backed by American homes. But on Thursday, vessels of refuge showed how quickly they can be rocked when too many investors pile in. Swiss authorities had already signaled their displeasure with excessive interest in the local money last week when they cut interest rates to zero. Yet investors, prodded by ultra-low rates in the United States, kept buying. More stringent measures would be needed to hold off the masses, and media reports about possibly linking the soaring franc to the wobbly euro managed to send the Swiss currency tumbling. Gold bugs were abated, if perhaps temporarily. CME Group, of the U.S. operator of derivatives and other exchanges, ramped up margin requirements for gold futures to slow the stampede. As a result, the ultimate escape for doomsayers, inflation hawks, and speculators alike watched the price of their precious yellow metal fall more than 3% at one point on Thursday. U.S. debt and government-guaranteed mortgage bonds have also seen an influx from investors trying to navigate the current storm despite the country's loss of its AAA credit rating. The 10-year Treasury note was yielding as little as 2.17% on Thursday morning, 1.56 percentage points lower than its 2011 peak. Bonds backed by U.S. home loans also got a massive lift this week when the Federal Reserve indicated it would keep funding costs extremely low for 2 years. That locks in an easy, seemingly safe profit for those borrowing short and investing long. It's no wonder investors aren't feeling much buyer's remorse, given that yields are much lower than inflation, running at 3.6% on an annualized basis. Here come the punchlines, ladies and gentlemen. There's, of course, a difference between speculative bubbles caused by greed and psychological ones born of fear. But so-called safety trades can blow up much the same way as risky ones. It's just the policymakers, rather than the invisible hand, that the policymakers, rather than the invisible hand, are the more likely holders of the pin. Changing currency pegs in Switzerland, allowing the yuan to appreciate in China, or ongoing bullheadedness in Washington could make today's emergency rafts look less seaworthy. Worse, if inflation turns out to be the real threat, investors may find themselves paddling feverishly to change course. That's a huge story, and that again confirms. And 4 months now on the CollapseNet website, in my writings and my April warnings, I have said clearly that what was coming in to a head in July and has manifested now throughout August, actually started July 21, would lead to a period of quote unquote extreme disorder. And disorder is when you like hit the puree switch on the wearing blender. Because now the money that is afraid, that doesn't know where to go, is running frenetically in many different directions, and all it takes now is the slightest upset to send this into a totally chaotic financial situation. I hope we have a smoother week than last week. Anyway, so there we are with that. But this is a great time now that that the world is so obviously Kremt, to bring on the two guests that I have tonight. There is a movie called Anima Mundi, and I, as I told Gary at the end of his show, this is like the coming out party for Gaian spirituality. It is an amazing film. I was interviewed in it, but I had no idea what the finished product was going to look like. I just did like a little snapshot, and I had no idea how it would be beautifully assembled by director Peter Charles Downey. This is his first film. The movie features David Holmgren, who is also with us tonight. He is a legend, something of an icon to those of us on this side of the infinite growth line. John Seed from Deep Ecology, Stephen Harding, Vandana Shiva, me, Michael Reynolds, Noam Chomsky, Dr. Mark Omidra, Dr. Christine James, and Permablitz with Permaculture. It's a great film, and it has changed the way I view things. And it's given me some amazing new perspectives, which I think is what we're all after tonight. I screened the movie here at my house about 3 weeks ago, and in the audience was the National Chair of Transition U.S., Caroline Staton, and she was blown away. And this movie is just coming out. So let me shut up a little bit and bring some guests on tonight. I'd like to welcome first Peter Charles Downey. Peter, you there?
Yeah, Michael, thank you.
All right, and David, are you there?
Yes, Michael, good to speak with you.
Hey, mate, good. Okay, let me go first to Peter. First, Peter, tell us briefly what the movie's about, but more importantly, where it can be seen and how it can be seen.
Okay, well, I guess to start off with, perhaps I'd like to say what Anima Mundi actually means. It's a Latin term, which means soul of the world. And goes back to ancient times when people believed that the earth was a whole living organism, which was sort of, it's like we're almost coming full circle back around to that sort of belief these days. And it was interesting how you said it's changed you a lot, and it's changed me a lot as well, making the whole film, and the synchronicities and things that happened, you know, that began as this tiny little seed that has just turned into something.
It has a life of its own, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. That's one thing I've really learned. You know, this is my first main film, and I've learned that, yeah, once you get out there, things do take on a life of its own. And in a sense, it's like, it began, I was supported because I'm unemployed, and it was a way of to get myself self-employed, and I'm all supported by the local community. So I put this film together by a local permaculture group who provided me some money so I could get around and interview people and such. But I also felt very much that I was supported by Gaia, by the planet, because of the synchronicities that happened in the making of it. Okay. So, for example, when I first moved to this town and the community that I'm in, before I was here, I was homeless. I was living in my car, and I didn't know where I was going to find, and there's not many places to rent, and I stopped into this real estate agent. And they had this beautiful bluestone cottage for rent and amazing views and all that. It was quite actually cheap. And I thought, wow, I've got to check this out. And I opened up my Melway, so a street directory. We call them Melways here. And to check it out, the street directory was given to me about 10 years prior by a wildlife charity I used to volunteer for. And so I opened it up to check out where the address is, and literally with a pen was drawn in there, the long driveway and the house I was just going to look at. And it was like almost like it was mapped out for me.
You know, it's funny how all of this works. I know that we have like a ton of people out there tonight. We have a very large audience tonight, and welcome to everybody to Lifeboat Hour. Mm-hmm. And they all want to know where and how they can see the movie. Is it out in the U.S.? I know it's screened in Melbourne and Sydney, right?
Okay, yeah, screenings are available anywhere in the world at the moment, and the DVD is only available in Australia at present, but the download in DVD is going to be available any day now through everywhere around the world. We haven't got a massive distributor behind it, and there wasn't some big dating, big promotional money behind it, so it's growing organically.
What's the website?
Yeah, I know the DVD. Sorry?
What's the website?
Oh, the website is animamundimovie.com.
animamundimovie.com. Yeah, it's an amazing movie, and let me say hi to David here. David is is one of Australia's most experienced permaculture site designers. He's been doing consultancy and advice design for 20 years now. He lives at Hepburn Springs in central Victoria for 15 years or so. He's developed an intimate knowledge of regional landscape. He's the co-founder of permaculture. What can I tell you? You know, he's David Holmgren. David, welcome.
Good to speak to you, Mike and Peter. Have Peter on the line.
What do you think about this movie we found ourselves in?
Well, I was perhaps almost as surprised as you as to how large a role permaculture had generally. But I was struck by the way in which Peter connected the different participants in the movie on what they were saying about the world situation and about our relationship to the planet, and how the connection between the different participants was so clear. So that was, for me, really, really special.
I was blown away by how the different analyses by everyone from you to me to John Seed and Mike Reynolds and, you know, everybody just kind of fit together like this perfect mosaic to paint a picture of a planet which is alive. And there were several key moments in the movie for me, and I want to ask about a couple of them. Who was it in the movie who said the planet cannot afford to pay mankind's debts?
Yeah, totally.
Who said that? Which one was that? Was that John or Michael or?
That actually comes up in writing. That was something I've sort of realized. If you add all the world's debt all together, besides the United Americas, if you add the whole world debt together, the planet can't possibly afford to pay it with its environmental health and the resources that are left, and the available resources that are left in the region to get to and such. The planet can't, because ultimately the planet is what pays human debt. Because we pick up
Then there was a whole long thread that I think, David, you developed well, and this is where I want to probe a little bit, because this is where I've had my own spiritual revelation on this. And I've been, you know, doing the spiritual stuff for a long time too, but there was a segment in the movie where it was articulated that when man landed on the moon in 1969, that was at the moment when Mother Earth, who is a part of all of us, that's obviously where every molecule that we contain, hold, so-called possess, comes from, that she was in effect looking back at herself. And it was a monumental moment of awareness. But then the theme was developed that, David, you can speak to this, that maybe she's been on like a binge here, and she's trying to come out of this binge, which would explain a lot of the climate change and would also explain an apparent shift in human consciousness. David, take that and run with it anywhere you want to go.
Yeah, well, I suppose, first, Mike, I'd say that I come to the whole spiritual perspective from a sort of a deep atheist background,
mm-hmm.
and a sort of reluctant, maybe from a sort of a cultural and emotional point of view, gradually moving to a point at where the idea that the Earth is alive makes more sense than saying that it acts like it's alive or looks like it's alive.
Mm-hmm.
So, that's the first point, that over time I can see that is a functional way for humans to think about the planet. Because my starting point is coming from what is ecologically functional over time tends to persist. And that's, if you like, a pretty scientific sort of hard-nosed view. And it seems that this empathetic connection with others and with the larger environment has been functional for humanity over most of its history. So, you know, whether that's a sort of like true or not in that sort of hard reductionist sense is really not so relevant, because it's that way of understanding that produces functional behavior that is most important. And thinking of the Earth as alive and thinking of ourselves as part of her consciousness is completely appropriate. So I was actually quite taken by that idea that the Apollo mission represented this reflective looking back. As far as the idea of Gaia being on a binge with the fossil fuels or what's happened in recent geological history, I'm really comfortable with that idea that the system goes through pulses or changes that actually almost threaten its own survival. And we know from geological history that Gaia has gone through other extraordinary pulses, even far more severe than the ice ages.
Right.
The biggest being the arrival of oxygen into the atmosphere, which almost killed off the first billion and a half years of Gaian life in the anaerobic life. And yet she survived that and digested that and produced this huge flowering of aerobic life that is ones that need oxygen. I'm very confident that the pulse of fossil fuel extraction and the heating of the planet that's happened, that she'll digest that too.
Yes.
And I think that's a sort of an empowering story about, even in our darkest moments, about what we might have unleashed or what we might do, that we're still part of this larger system which will move ahead.
Well, that's that was one of the seminal moments for me in the movie, when I understood that she had sequestered all this carbon in the first place in the form of oil, natural gas, to take carbon out of the atmosphere to protect the life that was on the surface. Which was an amazing concept, and as I kept watching the movie, the revelations kept getting bigger and bigger. We're coming to a point in the show where every week, because I kind of insist on mixing art with the left brain stuff, because it's how I stay sober, especially lately, where we play a song from New White Trash, and it's an appropriate song. One of the songs that I wrote most of. And I was writing this song as we live now at the edge of a large cliff, to future generations, trying to say, we're sorry for what we left you, but fortunately we know that having people like David Holmgren and Peter Charles Downey and in the world, we're not leaving them all bad stuff. Anyway, here's Weird Kind of Sense. We'll be right back.
Oh, what a mess we left you. Against the odds of the gods, we left you such a mess.
Posting on tea and champagne, often left for a dry disdain. Camped by the fire in full moonlit time, under the change of a changing world of vain. What a
dedicate that song to a generation around the world, whether it be from London to Ireland to Greece to Egypt to Yemen to Israel to Syria to China, anywhere in the world. I'd like to dedicate that song to the generation which looks out and sees that it has, apparently to them, no hope, and that is increasingly frustrated at the world that we have left them. I just wanted to acknowledge that someone of my generation saw that, and my generation includes some great lights like Joni Mitchell, Stephen Stills, Bob Dylan, Jackson Brown, Dave Crosby, Graham Nash, who we started something. I think it's time we finished it. You can find the song at www.newwhitetrash.com. That's our band. All the sales of our CD go to my bandmate, Doug Lewis. He and I co-wrote that song, who was suffering with stage 4 cancer. So that's how we're taking care of our friend that way. Welcome back to the Lifeboat Hour. I want to go back over to Peter now. You hit on something earlier, Peter, that that really is familiar to me, which is the sense of being led through this project and being facilitated. I just moved here to Northern California 4 months ago, and what's happening on this 2 acres that we have is amazing, and the connections that are being made and the people that are being lined up. And I do sense a change of consciousness. Do you kind of really feel that this film is being carried, if you will?
Oh, totally. Totally, Michael. Ever since I moved to this town and the community, I ended up like similar to perhaps what you're in now. My life really began to change like that. And again, the synchronicities that happened to bring this whole film together, and the synchronicities that are still happening, and the connections I'm making now for the sequel and where that's going to go. And so
sequel, hold it. Wait a minute. Sequel, well, stop. I just hit the emergency cord here. Tell us about the sequel.
We're busy putting the sequel together at the moment, because it's going to be, well, I think it's a step better than the first film in a way. Now I've got connections with a professional media company who've got better gear than what I've got, sort of thing, and they're deferring payments and things like that and helping me out, so because they're very passionate about the message of the film as well. Perhaps one thing I wanted to add, you were saying a little bit earlier about there seems to be one of the things I dislike, and I mean no disrespect to Aboriginal people anywhere, but one of the things I dislike is when our government wants us to fill out a form and we've got to tick Indigenous and non-Indigenous, and I feel that that's one of the things missing from the white fellow is that we're all Indigenous. We're all Indigenous to the earth. It's made up of different races and our cultures. But, yeah, we're all Indigenous. So.
Well, that's a great point. So I'll throw this out to either one of you. We've talked about levels of consciousness and that Gaia is experiencing herself through the human experience, seeing herself with her own eyes, getting a little high on the stored energy that's here. But I recently gave a speech called The Post-Petroleum Human, in which I say that a new species is evolving, or has evolved, and that we are post-petroleum human who understand that there are certain sacred things like thou shalt not stick a paperclip into a light socket, and there are sacred ways in which to treat the earth with that. But now there's this division of consciousness, but then what does that say about our relationship to Gaia? Is that what we're experiencing? Is this blessing and being guided and protected, and what does that say about other consciousnesses, if that's a word?
It's an interesting question in that you could wonder why Gaia would create a species, especially the white fella, who thinks that it's separate from nature. Mm-hmm. What evolutionary purpose could there be to that,
And we're all white on this show.
That's right. I mean, one of the things, results of us burning all the fossil fuels and developing technologies that, and we can't turn back time now, we've done it now, but we've sent rockets up into space, and on board those rockets and bits of space junk and probes that are flying out into the galaxies, a Gaia and life, bacteria and things like that that have rebreathed onto the bits when they're being made in the factories and things like that. And so, in a sense, maybe You know, that was part of our job, was to help spread Gaian life throughout the universe. But then that's not to condone what we're doing either. So, but it's just, but it is the reality of what we're doing. And I guess if we want to continue to survive as a species, we're going to need to quite obviously change our ways.
Which involves, I think, first and foremost, a change of consciousness. And what this movie told me was that this change of consciousness, I think, is much further along than I thought it was. David, would you agree with that?
Yeah, I think obviously these things come in pulses, and it's during those pulses that you can see what might have been building up for a long time. So, for example, I see the pulse of consciousness around these things that I think, Mike, you alluded to, that was sort of concentrated in the 70s, appeared to sort of disappear, but the... if you like, the meme about the limits to growth, the meme about some sort of non-material transformation in humanity rather than just constant growth in material power, were seeded like into what was effectively an emerging global culture at that time, you know, coming out of the dominant Western Anglo-American world, but really becoming part of a sort of a global culture. And so those seeds, even though a lot germinated and, you know, on barren ground, when conditions change, as they, I believe there was a sort of another big pulse in the late 80s, early 90s, and then when now we're into this huge flowering of a lot of those results, because those sort of realities that were predicted or suggested are actually emerging. And it is hard to know how much people are capable of switching and changing quite dramatically as a result of embedded thinking. I think that can change extremely fast. What is more difficult to change, of course, is you can't fast track the growing seasons and become a competent food gardener just by believing it's a good idea. Or you know, a lot of the things, of course, we need to do is part of that tragedy that, you know, we haven't done those. And there's that incredible sort of grief that will be part of that process of, well, you know, if we'd only done this or made those changes longer ago.
Yeah.
But I think the capacity for psychosocial transformative change as a wild card, a bit like the wild cards of the money markets, but in a positive way, is definitely there.
You know, you were talking about the 60s and the 70s. I just pulled up a set of lyrics written by Jackson Browne in his first album, Late for the Sky, which came out, I think, in 76, probably written in 75 or 76. The song is called Before the Deluge, and this is the third verse of that. And this just blows me away as I read this now, David. The verse says, "Some of them were angry at the way the earth was abused by the men who learned how to forge her beauty to power. And they struggled to protect her from them, only to be confused by the magnitude of her fury in the final hour. And when the sand was gone and the time arrived, in the naked dawn, only a few survived. And in attempts to understand a thing so simple and so huge, believed that they were meant to live after the deluge." I still get choked up when I read that.
Quite extraordinary.
And so this, to me, is evidence of a consciousness that I have sensed my whole life. I tell my friends it's kind of drugged me around my life to bring me to this point. I only have one story to tell, and this is the consciousness that gave me the story that I tell now, where I can say I think I can speak for all of us on this side of the line of infinite growth that all they have to do is say my name. You know, for the work that I've done, and they see all of us, but they can't see us. In the last show, Gary Null talked about a psychological malfunction, where people can't refuse to see things because as soon as they see them, they have to accept responsibility. And that's the awakening or the revelation, or if you were to use the Greek word, the apocalypse, that's coming. And it's a very, very trying emotional thing. David, you've been watching this for a while. I would call you probably the fastest camper in the world, because you've been at this for so long. What kind of emotional rides do you take with what's happening in the world? And then we'll come back and ask Peter the same question.
Well, I think it's a hard balance, but I think I was informed by growing up in a family of political activists who, where there was a strong commitment to what was ethical and right.
Mm-hmm.
In the world, but essentially most of it was a struggle against the world we don't want. And at times, or perhaps always, that feels like an overwhelming struggle. And I suppose permaculture for me in the mid-1970s and the connection I made with Bill Mollison, virtually a generation older than me, was after 10 years of environmental activism, was coming to that same point. Why don't we just create the world we do want in parallel, not in ignorance of all the bad things that are happening? And so I think that aspect of permaculture has been what's been so attractive for so many people, because the focus on the bad things, of course, is in the end so debilitating to one's not just one's emotions, but one's bodily survival in the end. You know, because these things eat away at us in various ways. So I think that for me, the connection back to when I say the focusing on the positive things, it's also down at that very small scale of, you know, connecting with the seasons, growing your food, experiencing the joy of that, you know, first fruit of the season. But yeah, the season's still working. Hey, you know, like, you know, that thankfulness for those small, simple things, and that is what allows the larger scale work. Because it's both grounding too much stuff in the head, which is a challenge for some of us, and it's also those pure simple things that really are the core of the larger message we need to give. So I suppose that's how, you know, the balance for me has always been between the work in the world and no, I just need to, you know, get the seasonal garden in and do that, and that's all what, you know, and deal with those practical things around me. So that balance, if you like, between life-work balance.
The movie we're talking about tonight is Anima Mundi, and you can find it at www.animamundimovie.com, animamundimovie.com. Do anything you can to see and watch this movie. I started laughing, David, because I discovered that it was time to start harvesting the apples when they started falling off the tree. It's amazing how that works. And I'm on 2 acres here, blessed in Sebastopol, surrounded by some enormous permaculture experts, including the Occidental Arts and Ecology Center, and many good friends here. And we're getting deeply into permaculture here. We have like 40 plus edibles now. Our corn's coming in, potatoes. We're building a greenhouse down the lower 40. We got like 4 microclimates here. We've got 2 acres that drop 60 feet front to back, and it's just an amazing playground. Doing that, everybody out there tonight, if you have a question for David Holmgren or Peter Charles Downey, and Peter, I owe you an answer to that last question too, if we remember what it was. 1-888-874-4888, 1-888-874-4888, or email me directly at lifeboathour@collapsenet.com. Who's bringing you this show tonight? Yeah. Okay, Peter, Sorry.
Yeah, well, I'd perhaps like to add from a psychological sort of angle, I guess you did say, like, this, what happened with the riots recently in the UK.
Yeah.
And one thing we all got to watch out for is that we've all been brainwashed since we've been babies to be consumers and to buy shit that we don't really need, that we think is going to make us happy. And you see all those rioters out there, and they're breaking into stores and getting the latest clothes and phones and all like that, and they think that's going to, you know, I'm sure there's other reasons behind the riots, but, so I can see from a psychological point of view, we're going to need to get used to being happy with less, and to know that we don't need all the latest plasma televisions or things like that, you know, to be happy. But also, the other thing I see getting played at the moment is, like, it's almost like game theory with climate change, is that on one hand we have oil companies and coal corporations and such promoting climate skepticism.
Yes.
And on the other hand, you've got corporations greenwashing with, bullshit environmentally friendly things. Like General Electric, for example, they make wind turbines and they make solar power plants and things like that. And they also make nuclear bombs.
Yeah.
And it's just, you know, it's insane to think, you know, it's just insane. Those CEOs, you know, I guess, need to have a good hard look at themselves in a way, but that's insane to pretend that you're trying to be environmentally friendly when you're also making, you know, weapons of mass destruction.
Well,
like, that scene we used in the film with Obama talking about the Green Hornet and the new environment fighter jet. The depleted uranium bombs you're firing are environmentally friendly. Like, it's just crazy.
It is abysmally insane, and that's only going to get worse as we go on. I mean, I see the commercials now for clean coal, and I've almost shot my television set twice.
I have on that, Michael, is that as things become, the contradictions inherent in the system become more extreme, the contradictions play out in this very, very dramatic way where they're so absurdly visible. And I think that also plays out in our own lives, that for example, if you're a successful environmental thinker, then it's, even though we have technologies like we're using at the moment, it's almost inevitable that you have to spend a lot of time on planes and through airports and processing through the worst aspects, in a way, of what our global industrial system is.
Yeah,
a mechanism to project and pursue, important work in the world. Now, I don't have a sort of a judgmental take on, whether environmental activists should be flying or whatever. But what I'm saying is that as the system goes into this endgame, these extraordinary contradictions start being expressed at every level, from the corporate level right down to the personal. And I think that's actually an opportunity for transformation, because it shows the structure of the reality we're living in.
We have a caller. We have a caller on the line. Josh from Chicago is on with us. Josh, you there?
Hello.
Josh, you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
You're on, man.
Hey, I just wanted to call in, and I called in before a couple months ago, but figured I'm calling in. But just wanted to ask you guys. I've been listening to what Mike's been saying for a long time, and I'm 21. I'm going to school in Chicago, and I'm kind of like in a situation where I got a lot of responsibility on my hands, and I kind of want to change my lifestyle towards the transition that's coming, and I just don't know how to start, that first step. I feel like there's always a first step. You got to take an action that you take that kind of puts you in the direction that you want to go, and I just don't know how to take that first step. And I was wondering if you guys had any suggestions or something like that.
David, Peter?
Yeah, permaculture design course.
Yeah. Permaculture is, this is the most, I can stand in one of my garden beds and I can eat a whole salad with 7 or 8 fresh vegetables that I pick live off the plant and say thank you. That will change you faster than anything. Peter, you got anything?
Well, that's Peter's answer was,
permaculture
design course. But it is true that for a lot of people, a design course is a sort of helps them put together a sort of like a map of or a plan of what they need to do in their own lives, rather than it being necessarily a technical download on the particular skills you need. The other thing that I would say is that the experience I had when I was young was that I was so enthusiastic about working on other people's properties, using their money and their resources so I could learn and experiment. And I saw that as a great asset because I believed that what you have between your head and your hands and your heart, what you carry away is more valuable than even, you know, the ability to own land or anything like that, because it's what you carry with you everywhere. So it's that building that experience and building those social network connections. And one of the strongest ways that's happened connected to permaculture has been the worldwide woofing network, willing workers on organic farms, of people just mostly young people, but not necessarily traveling to places that host people and doing work in exchange for food and getting
what was
that
sort the woofer
of like,
was that the woofer
inside
network? How do people
experience.
Find it? How do people find it?
You can find that network on the web.
How do you spell it then?
Willing workers on organic farms.
Willing workers on organic farms. Okay.
Okay.
Peter, there was some crosstalk there. Didn't quite hear your response, and you haven't had a shot here for a minute. Jump in. Do we have Peter? Okay, Josh,
yeah,
I'm going to talk to him.
I jumped out for a second.
I'm sorry. Peter, are you there?
Yeah.
Okay. You haven't had a shot for a couple minutes here. You got anything you want to say? And then I'll answer Josh quickly, too.
Oh, one of the things I'm finding within myself very interesting at the moment, because I've been helping at a few forest blockades and protests that are happening up in my area, and there's a battle I'm finding within myself is like, should I stop? You know, it's like the system is going to collapse on its own accord. It's quite obvious now, and should we stop fighting it, trying to bring it down when it's going to collapse on its own, and direct our energy now to preparing and creating the alternative change? And so I'm finding that interesting within myself at the moment.
My
energy there.
Yeah, I'm totally saying we have to kill this beast before it kills us. And there are ways to fight it. And Josh, my answer, too, is that if you have any investments in financial instruments, whether it's a 401k, an IRA, whether you have it in any kind of stock, any kind, sell it. Get it out. Get out of that market.
Yeah, I just sold my mutual fund.
Huh?
Yeah. I just sold my mutual fund, a couple weeks ago.
Good, good, because now is the time when we choose who we serve. Do we serve the planet that gives us life, or do we serve that which is trying to kill all life on the planet? And there's no middle ground here, and I've been very clear on this now for a few weeks, and that's a great psychological change that will also give you the spiritual impetus to move forward in changing your lifestyle, because in spirituality, as I practice it, intent is very, very important, and stated clear intent is something that you seek. Thank you for your call, Josh.
Yeah, no problem.
Okay.
It's funny that you're mentioning that, because we've been discussing that between friends lately, that what's going to become most important as things collapse, a bar of gold or, you know, a slab of cans of baked beans, which is going to be more valuable. And obviously, what has the real tangible wealth there is the food. So,
in a way, that's artificial, because as gold prices continue to soar, if you have an ounce of gold, you can buy 10,000 cans of beans in a little while, whereas a lot of people are going to be starving. But it's a mixture of more than that. It's the heart. It's the intent. It's the spirit. It's what you do, how you mix all that together in your own lifeboat, your connection with the land, the food you grow, and the way you live your life. we're going back. I have an email here, which is good. Talk about grounding. This is about as grounding as it gets, guys. David, we had a discussion last week on the show. I'm plagued by gophers here, and I kind of tend to lose my spirituality around gophers. We had a big, long discussion. Somebody suggested blood meal as a repellent, and somebody, Durfer, writes in saying, best the community be careful of blood meal. It contains exactly the body parts that are known to harbor Crutchfield-Jacob disease, which is Matt Cow. The cryons that make up this disease are fearfully tough, blah, blah, blah. So there's a problem there. I guess, go for solutions, and what's your experience with blood meal, if you have any?
Well, we don't have gophers here, but...
You've got a lot of other funny critters.
Other marvelously ingenious Australian creatures, which probably cause as many problems. I suppose the key thing with pests is whatever the technical solutions, we have to be aware of that all of us are part of that ecosystem.
Right.
And that doesn't mean to say we necessarily leave the pests to get our food, but we need to recognize that they're just going about their life too. And I saw this most clearly in the 70s with friends of mine who were having their gardens destroyed by possums in Tasmania, and were at the level where they were sort of hitting the possums over the head with lumps of wood. And I said, just get a rifle, shoot the possum, make some nice fur thing out of the skin and eat the possum, but don't hate the possum.
Mm-hmm.
And I suppose that sort of utilization of things that are in surplus is part of the creative capacity of humans. How do we treat what's an abundance, what there's from our point of view an excess of, as an abundance? And it's a bit like Mollison said, you don't have a plague of snails, you just have a deficiency of ducks. And I know, like, some of those things might be glib in terms of a particular technical problem with a pest that, I don't have any experience of and therefore don't have any answers, but I'm sure there's other people probably in your own region that do have some of those answers and experience. So I think that local knowledge is always really important. And I often say to people when they say to me, can you come and do consultancy on a farm on the other side of the planet? I say, well, there's quite a possibility that there's the person you're looking for is actually close by.
Mm-hmm.
And that so often that distant fields being always greener, that the answer is always somewhere else. Sometimes it's very close.
And we have an email from GB. Hi, Mike. What do these gentlemen have to say about radiation coming down in the rain? They've measured high around Vancouver, BC, Canada. Thanks. Keep up the great work. Just quickly for me, there hasn't been much of a problem at all with radioactive rain since the original Fukushima incident. We track that extremely closely at collapsenet.com. Thank you all so much for the support. You love what we're doing, and we've been clearly serving you pretty well out there. And I want to thank all of you who have joined us as new members. But I don't think radioactive rain is an issue down in Australia, is it, guys?
No. Look. Peter?
Oh, no, go, Dad. You go first.
We haven't had problems here in that regard. And I think generally the fear about nuclear radiation may be a bit worse than it needs to be. Obviously, there is going to be some bad results, as we move into energy descent future with more things like Fukushima, and those things are going to be horrific in the regions they happen in. But I think sometimes that fear is worse than the actual
you
problem.
Have one
but I think
remaining.
It is important to keep monitoring those things. And obviously, things like stored food in the normal, sensible way of a self-reliant household, do provide some sort of options in those sorts of events.
I think we're going to lose you, David. We called you on a calling card. You just got the one-minute warning for your card on the air. If I don't get to say it, God bless you, man. Thank you so much for the work that you do. I'm so proud to be on this field with you. You can see David Holmgren and many more of us in the movie called Anima Mundi, which is out of Australia. It's really kind of rocking the world. Oh, it's Peter we're losing. I apologize. Peter, we may have lost you. If so, Peter, thank you for being on the show. And are you still there, Peter?
You have no time remaining.
There we go. We have no. You have no time remaining. Peter, thank you. All right, so we have to let the technology voice. Isn't it nice to know they're going to be going away soon? End this. Okay. We won't have to listen to that anymore. Isn't that nice? I'd much rather listen to a red-tailed hawk that sings outside my window every day. David, you're still here, right?
Yeah.
All right, it's you and me for the last 5 minutes, buddy. What would you say to so many people in the world on our side of the line at various states of awareness right now? What kind of a pep talk would you give to people right now, and what would you tell them about the world?
Well, I think getting connected in your local community, and if you don't have a local community, deciding where that local community is, I think is probably one of the most important things. And I think everyone's situation is sort of very different, but I think we need to focus and see what the opportunities are as the changes come rolling. And that's a lot of the focus of my future scenarios work. It wasn't intended to sort of scare people witless about what the future might look like. It's actually accepting that it can actually unfold in quite different ways in different situations. And, we've put a lot of resources on our website in relation to permaculture.
And what is your website, David, please?
That's holmgren.com.au.
holmgren.com.
Yep.
.au.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
David.
Maintaining those connections, that there's a lot of other people doing similar things, and to stay focused on those.
And the grounding aspect is extremely important. You said something that has been a very serious challenge for me, which is getting so deeply into my head with the agonies of collapse that are obviously getting worse, that grounding, balancing, getting back out and just putting my butt on the ground or doing some physical labor is essential, and I think that's important for everybody now. Because the more you can do that, the more you come back into being in your own body, and being in that state of balance.
Exactly.
The movie we have been discussing tonight is Anima Mundi. Anima Mundi at animamundimovie.com. It's a new film out of Australia, which features in it a whole bunch of people. I had closed the script, but you'd be surprised who's in there. And what is said and what is revealed about Gaian spirituality and a Gaian perspective. And I guess most importantly for me, and David, I'll let you know like the last minute or two, but the most important thing for me is that when I live in that perspective, the world does not look as bleak as it does otherwise.
Yeah, and I think the other thing it'd be great to say about the film... sorry about printer noise in the office here. The other thing is that it's an extraordinary piece of art.
Mm-hmm.
And for people who respond to that amazing visual material. What Peter has done and the juxtaposition of images is just fantastic.
I'm afraid we're out of time. Our guests tonight have been Peter Charles Downey, director, producer of Anima Mundi, and David Holmgren, co-founder of Permaculture. This has been a great radio show. We'll see you guys next week on the Lifeboat Hour. Thank you, David. Good night.